Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by David Hunt and Ava Davis and produced by Brian DeShazer with technical assistance by Daniel Huestias, the producer of this week's special Pride feature. The Knack and Kessa performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson, composer, performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks John Beaupre of Los Angeles, California, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Thanks also to Los Angeles cannabis provider MMD Shops for being a This Way Out Pride partner. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WADR Janesville, Wisconsin, KPNW Bellingham, Washington, 2CHR Cessnock, New South Wales, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, stay prideful, and stay tuned.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Meetings are held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify that a meeting is being held.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. Today is Tuesday, July 9th, 2024, and you're tuned in for KBOO's 6th LGBTQIA2S+ community panel for our Pride series, celebrating the rich and vast heritage of our queer community. Today, we are speaking to Aaliyah Kefia, Liv Brown, Paul King, and Walter Jaffe for our queer arts panel, where we will discuss the intersection of art, work, and queer identities. To join in on the conversation and speak directly with our panelists, call 503-231-8187. Again, if you'd like to speak to our panelists or ask any questions, you can call 503-231-8187. To support KBOO and programming like this, donate today at kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Ave, Portland, Oregon.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for being here with us. I just want to start by getting everybody's name, pronouns, and age.
Hi, my name is Liv Brown. My pronouns are she, they, and I'm 28. 29, just kidding.
Hi, I'm Paul King. I am 73, and my pronouns are he, him.
Hi, I'm Walter Jaffe. My pronouns are he, him, and I'm 76.
Hi, my name is Aaliyah Kefia. I use all pronouns, and I'm 28.
Amazing. And then if we could also go around and say a little bit about your gender and sexual identity.
Okay, I'll start. My gender, I identify as a genderqueer lesbian. I think that feels the most accurate. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Paul King. I identify as a gay man.
Yeah, Walter Jaffe, gay.
Aaliyah Kafia, I am a transgender being. I have retransitioned in my life. I've taken hormones. I've had surgeries. I consider myself queer, as in, you know, I'm going to follow whatever I want to do. I don't fit in a box.
Amazing. Thank you, everybody. And then just jumping right in, love to hear about everybody's art, how you got started, and where you are now.
So I'm Liv. I am a hairstylist here in the good old Portland, Oregon. I've done it for a couple years now, and I love it very, very much. I feel like I get to express my creativity while also being a part of a community. I do hair for a lot of queer people, and I really enjoy it.
Hi, I'm Paul King, and with Wally Jaffe, we co-founded an organization called White Bird in 1997. And we're going into our 27th year of bringing contemporary dance from all over the world to Portland.
And just to add on to what Paul just said, as of a year ago, January, we up until that point, we had been fully involved in the operations as co-founders and on the board of White Bird. However, we did hire an executive director, Graham Cole, and as of a year ago, we stepped away from leadership. We are still working closely with Graham, but we are also co-presidents of the White Bird boards, and that is our main role with White Bird at this point.
Hi, Aaliyah Kafia. I, as a transgender person, I think that my life is a performance art, and I think that's true for other transgender people and cisgender people too. Currently, I have an art show up with my art collective, Tribad, at 5859 Southeast 92nd Ave, Suite 2B. It'll be up till July 22nd, and I have some ceramic pieces there I made. There's some music videos, some short films, and some soaps. So I'm a multimedia artist. I do whatever I'm not supposed to do.
Great. Thank you all so much. And I'd love to know, what stage of life did you kind of come into your queerness or come out?
Oh my gosh, wow. That's a big question. I feel like I still am coming into my queerness in a lot of ways. I think I learn about myself and my identity every day. But I think it was around college when I really started to realize, like, oh, something, I think when I was a kid, I knew something felt different, but I didn't know or have the words or understanding for it. I wasn't around a lot of queer people growing up. My suburb of Portland, Sherwood, was pretty, I guess, it was in a bubble, and I don't feel like that bubble included a lot of things outside of a nuclear family structure, as far as I was aware of. And so, yeah, it took until kind of getting out and about in the world and meeting a lot of new people, I just was like, oh, wow, yeah, definitely a lesbian.
This is Paul King. Well, things were very different in the 60s and 70s, and I think I struggled with my identity considerably, and there weren't a lot of out people, you know, or they were sort of, I guess you call them Nelly. I know that term is used today, but back then, that's kind of how, you know, there were people on TV that were known, for that. It was kind of a caricature, and it was difficult. I had a lot of challenges with it.
It's a big question as for me, because honestly, I think from very, very young age, I suspect that I was gay, and we didn't use the word gay in those days. But over time, I mean, I had mostly male friends. They weren't sexual friends by any way. But it was really after I graduated college and spent a year in Germany on a Fulbright, and I had some friends, and we went to my first gay bar, and I was horrified. I didn't know where we were going, but then when I went in, I saw these men, and some were making out, and I just felt like I wanted to disappear. But in any case, that was my first real introduction. And then over the course of the between 22 and 30, I really became very comfortable. I developed my first relationship, went into New York City at the time. I was living in the East Coast. And that's really when I knew for sure what my gay identity was.
Aliyah Kafia, I regularly remember being a small child and being sort of hyper interested in people who were different, and different to a child from a very small town in rural Pennsylvania meant gay or transgender. And I didn't have any words for what being transgender meant until I was in college, actually 18 or 19. So my queerness was this innate part of me that I loved and wanted to be celebrated. But there was these ideas about gender and masculinity and femininity and who's supposed to perform what that were very confusing to me. But I always looked out for people like us in movies and art and media, and I just thought they were so neat. I thought they were so neat. I had to learn everything about them, and to allow myself to be myself was a huge journey. But I always wanted to look at people like Keith Haring. You know, I wanted to look at a famous gay artist who put their life and their work intertwined forever, you know? It was inspiring to see someone live unabashedly as themselves. But I didn't have words for that for many years.
Thank you so much, Aliyah. That leads me to another question. You talked a little bit about some of your queer influences in the art world, and I'd love to know from the rest of you if you have any kind of queer artist inspirations.
It's funny that you bring up Keith Haring, Aliyah, because I remember when I was in like the third grade or so, we did a kind of unit on like Keith Haring specifically, and I just remember being blown away by like him and his like kind of like, you know, way of going about his art by just kind of forcing it upon people, like just putting it out there in the world. I thought that was so cool, and to learn, you know, a little bit about his story and tragically how he passed due to AIDS. I remember just thinking, like, it really stuck with me in a way that I didn't understand at the time, but I just really, really liked his art style, and I really, really thought, man, he's so cool. And he had this website at the time that you could, like, create these collages out of his characters that he would draw, and I just remember being so enamored with that and thinking, like, wow, art is so cool.
This is Paul King. Walter Jaffe and I have been together for 42 years.
Woo!
Thank you. And we lived
long
before New York, before Portland. We lived in New York for 17 years. And you know, used to see taking the subway. Used to see Keith Haring's work on the subway walls, and
so cool.
And also in, I remember seeing him do a window of a shop, you know, like a storefront
window display.
He did it. He was a window display of a really well known bookshop. Yeah, it was fun to watch him create that, and he had his own store. He had a shop downtown New York. But I think for us and what we do, we bring contemporary dance, and so someone who's a very talented individual like Don Horn, who has Triangle Productions, and he focuses on queer playwrights and work that is queer. And we, our scope is broader. We actually have, I think for the fourth time, we have Le Ballet Trocadero de Monte Carlo coming this season, and they're known as the Men in Tutus. They do full ballets, classic Russian ballets, on point, the real deal as men. And they have a Russian ballet mistress who is very tough on them, and they do it for real. And there's a film, a documentary film, about the trocs, we call them, and it's called Rebels on Point. It's definitely worth seeing. So we bring gay work, you know, we bring queer work.
Yes, and again, there's Walter tagging on to what Paul said. The our mission is to bring the best in contemporary dance and making dance exciting, educational, accessible, and equitable for everyone. So we honestly, in our programming, and when we were programming for 25 years, we didn't really focus on whether a company or artist was gay or not. That was not the criteria. The criteria was, is the company, are the artists excellent, and how do they fit into our programming? There are certain companies and certain many dancers identify as gay, lesbian, and so on. And that is just the way it is in the dance world. But there are also straight dancers as well. So it's a little bit different because we don't create art. We appreciate art. We present art. We present dance. And through our perspective, which I guess you could say is a gay perspective, but still it's a perspective that we bring excellence of art to Portland, and we've been doing that for 25 years, and now it's shifted, of course. But we still see a lot of dance, by the way.
Yeah, I think to piggyback a little bit off of what Walter said and what was being said before, I think sometimes I've looked at art and I've seen excellence, and then I learned that artist was queer, and then I learned they were trans. I saw something there, and I saw excellence first. I saw humanity. It wasn't about trying to seek out some perspective. It was that the perspective was unique and exceptional. Some of my favorite artists happen to be gay, happen to be transgender, happen to be a different race or background from me, and they also are doing something special and unique, and that's what's compelling about their work as well, seeing them not just as a gay person, not just as an Asian person, a Black person. They are, you know, a human first. And one of my favorite photographers, to shout them out, rest in peace, Ren Hong, R-E-N-H-A-N-G. He was from China. He famously, unfortunately, took his own life when he was very young, but in the few years that he was in the photography world, his work was so impressive and so revolutionary and so groundbreaking that, to me, I think it forever changed some forms of photography. And when I try film photography for myself for fun to document my silly little life, I think of him and I use the same camera that he used until a generous benefactor gave him a really fancy one. But it was the main one they used for most of his life. And I've lived in China. I speak Mandarin Chinese. I studied it. It was my minor in college. And I lived in Shanghai twice. And I thought about how for him, it would have cost him almost a month's salary to buy this camera that was plastic, but very good. And it's about making sacrifices because your art's worth it. It's about working with what you have, and I see queer and trans artists, radical Black, brown, indigenous people of color do that, and that's the art I'm going to seek out.
Thank you so much. These are all very fantastic perspectives. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 for our 6th LGBTQIA2S+ panel, taking a look at queer folks in the arts. To join the conversation, go ahead and give us a call at 503-231-8187. Again, if you'd like to speak to our panelists or ask a question, you can call 503-231-8187. And to support KBOO, you can go to kbu.fm/give and become a member today. Our next question is coming from our host, Kate Chase.
All right. Kind of continuing this conversation, I'd love to talk a little bit about the ways that art and queerness intersect and those two different identities as an artist and a queer person, and how often the lines can become a little bit blurred. And yeah, I'd love to hear everybody's thoughts on that.
I think art and queerness, specifically like creativity and queerness for me, are so interlinked. And especially with my job as a hairstylist, I think every day I'm kind of like exploring the kind of ways in which those both play a role in my life. A lot of my clients, like I said earlier, are queer. And I think what's cool about my job is they trust me to kind of help them show or represent themselves in a way that might be more, what's the word? Like
authentic.
Understood, authentic yeah. To them and to their identities. And I get to have this job where I get to service the community. And there's nothing cooler than being able to do something creative while also servicing the queer community, because that is like, I just feel like having a job where I get to do that every day is like the dream.
Thank you. I think for me it's a little different. Walter was saying that we're honored to be here with these wonderful artists, but we don't think of ourselves as artists. I guess, you know, what we do is creative, but and from the point of view of, you know, my identity, I think what I strive for is to be inclusive in every way, in terms of the work, the art that we bring to our audience and to who comes to see it. We want to break down any barriers there might be that people have about seeing dance, or, you know, that it's an elite art form, or it's exclusive. We keep ticket prices low. We have we're part of a group that has Arts for All, which is a $5 ticket if you have the Oregon Trail card. And we have the NEST program. Of course, everything about White Bird is Birdie or Neggy, Eggy or Nesty. And the NEST program stands for No Empty Seats Today. And we have, I think, about 15 organizations that are nonprofit health service organizations. And the tickets that are donated by our subscribers, and also White Bird donates subscriptions to the clients of these organizations. So these are people that would never be able to come to a show like that, and they're not seated way up in the back where they might be if they had to buy a ticket themselves. They're in your seats, they're in good seats, and we want them to have the same experience as everyone else.
That's amazing.
It just occurred to me that, is Walter here again? Following up on Paul, in the very early days of Wiper, we had a sort of a preview season, and one of the companies we brought was Stephen Petone's company from New York, a company we really didn't know, but Stephen's company had come through Portland as part of the Portland State dance season, which was, it lasted for about 10 years and then stopped by the time we got here in 96. But in any case, when he brought Stephen, we became connected to Cascade AIDS Project. And because as gay men, we were very, very concerned about AIDS at that time, what was happening, having lived in New York through the AIDS epidemic. And we were so happy to see there was a very vibrant organization here. So we actually did it as this performance with Stephen Pertone as a benefit for Cascade AIDS Project. And that was the beginning of our very long-term relationship. Paul actually began onto the board of CAP. And we did, there was a restaurant, one of the first restaurants in the Pearl was called Bima, and they gave us, what, 200 seats?
200 dinners.
Yes. And it was really great. Other organizations that we've been involved with over time related to the gay community has been Our House at Portland. We, for a very long time, we were doing audience appeals in during our at our performances, raising funds for Our House, and bringing some of our dance companies to Our House. So we remain 100% committed to the various organizations serving the gay community and serving those with AIDS, and that's been always become a huge commitment for us as individuals and also in connection with Whitebird.
This is Aaliyah Kafia. I try to always think about accessibility within my art, and currently at our the art show that me and my art collective Tribad have up running. It's called I'm a Narcissist, and it's about surviving narcissistic abuse. I think that spaces that are open to the art should be accessible for people who want to wear masks and for people who are trying to stay, safe, because we think about the AIDS epidemic as something that has passed on. But it hasn't, and COVID is still a pandemic that we're in, and a lot of artists received support that was critically needed for them in 2020 that they would have been lost without, and then a lot of artists, they died, and they've been left behind. And I think as someone who's trying to think radically and use abolitionist practices, I think about engaging with my queer community by not getting them sick, by not getting them COVID, something that could cause death and could cause disabilities that make it unable for you to think straight, to walk, to eat food. I am suffering from long COVID. It's very difficult, and no one's going to want to talk about it. It's controversial in the same way that the AIDS epidemic was known as the gay disease. It's something that we just think we can ignore. So I challenge artists to think, even if they've maybe forgotten that we're living through a pandemic right now, let themselves forget that it's okay to continue to grow as a person and to challenge your art to be more accessible, because that will bring queer people, that will bring amazing people who have great artistic values, and it will challenge those who don't want to see art in the first place, who don't want to see gay people, who don't want to see gay people with fabulous haircuts or men in tutus or transsexuals making ceramics. They don't care about us, so we don't care about them.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for the very engaging answers. I'd like to remind anybody who is just tuning in that you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7, and you are tuning in for our sixth LGBTQIA2S+ panel, taking a look at queer folks in the arts. Unfortunately, we have some lovely art people in the arts on our panel today. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask them questions, engage with some of your own experiences, you can call us right now at 503-231-8187. Again, call in, join the conversation. We have some of the best people to talk to in town with us right now. 503-231-8187. Kate Chase, I know you had a question awaiting.
I sure do. I'd love to talk a little bit more about the art community, specifically here in Portland, the queer art community. I would just love to know how your art or the art world that you're in has provided you with a community here in Portland.
I feel like I kind of touched on this with our last question, but I feel like community is just such a part of being a hairstylist. I mean, I see so many people every day, every week. I meet everyone of different backgrounds, and I am blanking right now, so I'm going to pass it along to the next person. It's hard to go first, you guys.
Well, you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Thank you, Liv.
You know, coming from New York, you know, Wally and I lived there for 17 years, and we decided to move away. And we went to 8 different cities, trying to check it out and see where we might want to be. And actually, Portland wasn't on the original list, but both a friend of mine and Wally's brother suggested that we both go to see Portland because they had each been there. Been to Portland and had their own experience and thought that we should add it to our list. So we came out in January of 1996 when it was 2 weeks before the floods of 96. Mm. It was really raining hard. And within 3 or 4 days, we just fell in love with Portland. It was so engaging. People were friendly. They seemed to really care about each other. And the arts were important. And it had everything we wanted. And it seemed like a very manageable city. So we decided to move to Portland and didn't know one person when we moved here and had no idea what we were going to do. And this town allowed us to follow our dream and gave us a chance. And we're very grateful. I think the communities here, the gay community, but every community here is open and willing to listen and share. And if you engage them, I think, you know, it's mutually very rewarding.
I don't really have much to add to what Paul said, except over the years we've developed very strong relationships with gay couples, and but we consider the audiences that come to the Whitebird shows as our family. And that's the way we built Whitebird from the start, because from the very beginning, the audiences, not many people knew about contemporary dance. There was a core dance audience that had been attending dance performances at Portland State University and so on. But we built the audiences, and Paul and I, Kate, would come on stage before every single performance. And it became very clear that Paul and I were a couple. We never hid the fact that we were a couple, that we had been together since 1982. We actually tried to get married back in the earlier years when it was allowed, and then it was annulled. And then we actually did get married in 2016, and we told a lot of people that. And people just, there's absolutely 100% support. Personally, this is part of why we just love what we're doing, because this is such a unique community in Portland that gives us the support to do what we do, both as presenters and us personally as a gay couple. Yes.
This is Aaliyah Kafia. I remember as sort of a new addition to Portland, coming from a very small town in Pennsylvania from the East Coast, that this was a queer friendly space. I didn't grow up in a place where like 2 men or 2 women or someone who looked very gay, homosexual, that they could just walk around and live their life and not face violence from that. And I think that really changed my mind about giving myself permission to embrace what makes me queer, what makes me different, what makes me special. And there are a lot of artists who are queer here, and if you are thinking about gender divergency or deviance. Sometimes they don't entirely welcome you. So to find radical abolitionists to look towards where spaces of Black, queer, trans women are accepted, those are important spaces for people like us who are, even within the queer community, often overlooked or considered too difficult to support or unworthy of that support, especially for Black trans women who face the highest rates of violence of any other group. To this day, life expectancy is only around 33, which is terrible. We're losing members of our queer community at rapid paces, and we need to rally around them. But to make community, you know, maybe someone that you really don't like has to be able to feel welcome there. Because a community space is a space where you can come and see someone that you might not like, but you know that you both can be there. You can be in community together. You can still be amongst each other and say, we both belong here and we both deserve to belong here. And so there are artist collectives like the Mouth Breather Collective, shout out them, who have been doing some queer art markets and set clothings and tooth gems and tattoos. There's other queer artists who I absolutely love, and I see their art online shared by friends. I follow them. I look for ways to support them. I will look for ways to directly give money to queer artists or do art trades, and that often opens me up to friendships that I needed critically, that I was hoping for. And I take that sort of as my spiritual journey to find my tribe. Anyone can find their tribe, you know, queer or not. But find what makes you feel good, and whoever says do that, you know, follow them, go with them.
Thank you so much, Aaliyah, for bringing up the topic of inclusivity in the art world. I think that's really important. And that kind of leads me into my next question, which is, what are the unique challenges that you have faced while building your business or honing your art? And we can actually start down here this time to give Liv a break.
Thank you.
If you have thoughts, Aaliyah.
I'm so sorry. What's the question again?
No, sorry. I threw a curveball there. I would just love to dive more
into...
See,
it is hard to go for.
Oh, gosh. I feel for you, Liv. I feel for you.
The unique challenges that you face as a queer artist... developing your business.
Oh my gosh, yes. Communicating with others when I am struggling, which I'm mentally ill. I struggle so good, better than anyone. And asking for help, recognizing you can't do everything yourself, and learning that failure is the surest way to success. The best artists have failed the most, time and time again. You have to fail to grow and to change. You need to do your taxes. You need to think critically about what's working and what's not working. And only you can decide that. And, you know, it should be a passion of love, but love needs money. So think about how much money you could amass without doing a lot of work and not hurting anyone. It's hard, but it is worth it. And there are ways to make art that we've never seen before. I've seen musical artists bring about their careers on TikTok. I've seen people go overnight to comedy tours from an Instagram reel. And it's not to say that you're not successful if you don't do that, but imagine that the world is going to open up to you and you just have to be ready for it. So go out with that idea that you are going to succeed. It's already happened, but you have to get there.
Well, I'm sort of almost tempted to say, instead of artist, presenter, because that's what we do. We're not artists, we're presenters. And over 25 years, it's been hugely rewarding, and one challenge after the next. And it's not necessarily related to our gay identities, but it's just the world of the arts here in Portland and the world of the arts in the throughout the country. And the lack of, or sort of the insufficient support that we as presenters receive to do what we do. we've been very fortunate to have a very substantial audience, subscribers, and to a certain extent donors support what we do. It has nothing to do with our gay identity, but it does have to do with the support of the arts in Portland. This is something that, you know, don't really want to get into today, but the fact is, especially post-COVID, it's been even more challenging. But we are even more committed than ever in supporting the dance community, not only here in Portland, but Paul and I are extremely involved in supporting the dance, presenting throughout the country, throughout the North America, and it's really exciting to be so involved in this sort of mission. We feel like we're missionaries doing what we're doing.
Hi, this is Paul. I'll just follow up quickly, briefly. In to give a little bit of background, in the 1970s, there were 36 dance-only presenters in the United States. That's what we do. We present only dance. And now there's maybe 8 to 10. And we're the sole dance-only presenter west of the Rocky Mountains. Mm. So it's lonely. Few years ago, especially during COVID, but before that, it really got started, where we created a network for those presenters that do dance, so that we had a way to connect with each other. And we used to do it when we were at conferences together, and we saw each other, and we'd go to a bar, and then we got a room, and it grew. But during COVID, it was all on Zoom. And so we invited our Canadian presenter friends, and it's now North America, and we're now bringing in artists and presenters of dance from Mexico. And the last call that we had, there were 80 people on the call. And so it's something that's needed, because people are showing up for it, and they're engaging, and we're figuring things out, and we're sharing, and we're not all these islands that are disconnected, and we're bringing our issues together and trying to decide and wonder how together we can fix things. And the audiences haven't come back to pre-COVID numbers for many, many organizations. And there are a lot of challenges, but it is the Northwest, and what doesn't kill you makes you weirder.
I love that.
Too true. I think community and connection have been like part of what has made me as a hairstylist so successful. I think a lot of really wonderful people have given me a lot of great education, a lot of great knowledge, a lot of a space to do hair in. A lot of my success comes from other people in my community, and as well as like just learning to do hair in my backyard and having people trust me enough for me to mess them up a little bit sometimes, like when I was first learning. It's just the kind of like humanity of it all. Like, we all mess up, we all have our days, and through practice and through like care and supporting each other, you know, we all get better every day. And I think that's the greatest thing that I can take away from being a hairstylist and being an artist, is just that the love and care of the community is what trumps everything else.
I love that. Thank you. We touched on this a little bit in some other questions, but I wanted to delve more into the way that the art world is changing in the digital age, especially with like social media, and kind of the negatives and the positives and your experiences with that. Is there anyone who would like to go first?
I don't mind starting this time. I think a lot of tattoo artists, hairstylists, art, like fine artists, ceramicists, everyone, can, especially like younger, the younger generation can relate to the fact that a lot of people find you through social media, and it is difficult to have this full-time job where you're working your butt off in person and meeting people every day, and then you're like, oh, but when I get home, I have to go check my, you know, social media to make sure that people are seeing my posts, and I have to post every day so that I can find new clients or they can find me. And it is a grind. It's like there's no off switch with it, and I think it can be exhausting. And there, all the stylists I've talked to, we all have different levels of like how much we want to put energy into social media. I'll be honest, I put a lot more energy into the in-person interactions that I have, and I do definitely care about having a online portfolio because I want people to see my work when they find me through Instagram. Livy_cuts, by the way, if you want to follow me and see my hair cuts. But yeah, it's something that I try not to have in the forefront of my brain all the time, but it's hard.
Hi, this is Paul, and this is a great question because this is where we can really see the generational divide. And you know, Wally and I have done the best we can with social media and keeping up with technology. Graham Cole is our executive director. He's 30 years old, and he started with us when I think he was 26. And this is something very, you know, normal for him, very, very much part of who he is. His DNA he grew up in a digital world and is brilliant at it. And he's got a great team. We moved our offices out of our house. We're downtown, and we're 2.5 blocks from the theater. And they, Graham and Christopher Carvalho and our entire team are doing just an amazing job. But they have really taken the social media aspect of it to a whole nother realm, and are using the analysis that is available and really understanding it. I've always said to Wally, I like to talk to people on the phone and write letters. And if it wasn't for, you know, Whitebird, I would probably throw my computer right off the deck. But also, I first thing I do is check my emails. So we're all addicted.
True, 100% true what Paul says. I actually have I can acclimate myself pretty quickly to social media. I've acclimated myself willingly or unwillingly to a lot of developments over the last 25 years. When we first arrived in Portland, everything was print media. And we were so fortunate at Whitebird to get so much great print coverage in all the major newspapers. I mean, the Oregonian had very substantial arts coverage at the time, and Whitebird got a lot of coverage then. And the same thing with Willamette Week and other newspapers. And then we saw that all changing, and even with our advertising, I thought we just have to stick with print ads, but then we started realizing advertising is going to the digital age. And I was sort of kicking and screaming as we're going to the digital age. But that's what's happening now. And as Paul said, we have an incredibly talented team at Whitebird who is really embracing social media and knows what to do with it. I put stuff on Facebook mainly in connection to Whitebird. I don't use Facebook otherwise. But in any case, it's a really fascinating phenomenon how things change, and who knows what it'll be like in another 20 years.
Aliyah Kafia. So I am very proud to be part Syrian American. And I bring that up because Twitter, they basically covered the Syrian civil war over Twitter, and that changed the marketing of how we interact with current news on the internet, which impacts artists everywhere. And I think about the AI inventions and the algorithm, quote unquote, which is a very ancient word, actually. Look up when it was first used. It was a lot longer ago than you think. But I think about the algorithm and the ways in it, it doesn't allow certain artists to talk about what they're going through, especially indigenous peoples fighting for sovereignty, resisting. And I'm thinking about radical queer people in my community and myself that have had to fundraise and put forward a pretty pretty aesthetic and pretty pictures and draw images of real living people who are trying to escape genocide just to have someone pay attention, because our posts are going to be taken down, they're going to be banned, our accounts are not going to be able to exist simply for being Syrian, for being Palestinian, for being Black, for being indigenous, for being transgender, for being a sex worker, for being disabled. The list goes on. And when they decide that you just can't exist on an online platform, unfortunately, because that is how the way our world works now, you're being limited in which sphere you're allowed to discuss things. The public sphere, the idea that you can go to a coffee house and talk to people and engage amongst each other is an idea from the French Revolution that was critical in bringing about change to an oppressed mass. So when people who are online are talking about trying to help other people in situations and the algorithm suppresses it, you have to think about what art is uplifted, especially when we see AI art being pushed heavily on us right now, which is completely upsetting the market for people who are doing, you know, jobs on the fly. Maybe it's not quite the gig economy, but you're definitely an independent contractor. And people's rates are being not respected because someone says, you know, I can get this many images from an AI generator in this many seconds. But they don't tell you about how much water it takes to run those servers. They don't tell you about which governments are trying to use those AI technologies to track our faces to put us in prisons. It's really difficult to live in a world that is ever changing and leaving you behind. And the people who are affected most are the people who don't have the loudest voices being represented. And those people are in Jamaica, they're on small Pacific islands. And these people, you know, they deserve to be respected. So whose voice is respected on social media? Who gets to have their ad put in the paper? I don't think people like me can do that, so we sort of have to work with the algorithm and entice them in a way to just let us exist. And that's hard. It's hard to be disenfranchised in a way to not talk to others and meet others, because it gives you power. And that's why you see stuff like the TikTok ban going on, which, you know, was upsetting the music industry quite in a revolutionary way. Finally, artists being able to promote and drop their own music. That's different. It's different to be able to have a voice, even as someone who's maybe very famous or very privileged or just has a lot of money and access to stuff. They still can't do what they want, because to be an artist is to be subversive, and to be subversive is to want to be controlled by the state. And that's why states will often kill artists, to try to kill the nation's spirit, because without art, a people can't heal. You'll be in a traumatized state, and you can't draw, you can't sing, you can't dance, and that is not what humanity is about. That's not what life is worth living for. So I think that when you go online, think about why you're following certain people. Think about what they're showing you, making you feel. Are they trying to sell you something to make you feel bad about your body or yourself or your own art? Because don't buy it. Don't buy it if that's the case. Look for stuff that makes you feel things. Even if it's anger, that's an emotion. So, you know, the internet's a hard place to be on. It can feel very unsafe, but I think it's a temporal space. I don't think we'll have the internet forever. It, you know.
all we'll have left is the radio.
Yeah. The radio.
I think that was the perfect question, too, to really hone in on all these different perspectives we have before us, which is very exciting. And if you are just tuning in, this is a reminder that you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 for our sixth, that's right, number six, LGBTQIA2S+ panel. And we're taking a look at folks in the arts community. If you want to join in on this conversation as we close the hour, you can give us a call directly at 503-231-8187. Again, if you have something to say to our panelists, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And to support KBOO, you can check out online at kboo.fm/give. And Kate Chase has a very engaging question for our panelists.
I hope it is engaging. As we kind of wrap up here, I just want to ask about what everybody's goals are going forward for their business or for their art, and where you're hoping to take it.
This is Liv Brown here, hairstylist here in Portland, Oregon, at, should I mention, Enjoy Co. Hair Studio, which is a really, really awesome collective of very talented hairstylists. We've got barbers, we've got colorists, we've got salon stylists and everything in between. I would say for me, as a raging perfectionist, that my biggest goal is just to get as amazing as possible at cutting hair as I can. And I don't know exactly what my future in hair looks like right now, but I know I'm enjoying it every day. And I just want to keep honing in my craft, meeting cool people, and hanging out with queers.
This is Paul King. It's a little bit different for us that we're not, running Whitebird like as we used to. But there is one thing that I think Wally and I would love to be able to do again. I think it was, might have been for our 10th or 15th anniversary, we did something very special. It was called Le Grand Continental. And it was an opportunity to work with a professional choreographer based in Montreal. And he came here and worked with, we were able to invite 164 non-professional dancers. And it was a little bit of a challenge, but we wanted it to be a celebration of Portland's diversity. And coming from New York, that was a very different thing being here. And so consequently, we worked hard on reaching out to a lot of different communities. And we had 164 non-professional dancers that took the summer. They rehearsed twice a week for 10 weeks. And we performed two live free shows at Pioneer Courthouse Square. We had 5,000 people come. And it was just the best thing that I've done with Whitebird, and very rewarding. Every one of those folks was so happy being there, so appreciative that they were working with a professional choreographer. We would love to be able to do that again someday if we can get the funding to do it.
I was going to say the same thing as Walter. That's why Paul and I are often on the same wavelength. That's why we work well together. We have different skills, but we're always very compatible. I just want to say, even though we're not so involved with the day-to-day operations of Whitebird as we've touched on, we need our audiences back. And we're not talking just about dance, but with all audiences here in Portland. We need to get our audiences back in the house to see work live. It's so essential that people get off their phones, their screens, and so on. And we're going to do everything we can. I'm doing the, but when I say, I know that Paul agrees with me, we're going to do everything we can to get people coming to our performances, and we're going to support the other arts organizations as much as we can to get people coming to their shows. We have personal relationships with a lot of those other organizations.
It's just something we believe in.
Okay.
Leah Kafia, my biggest goal is to have someone connect with my art, to just look at it, to feel something from it. Even if they don't like it, that's perfect. I want to make queer and trans people feel like they are welcome in any space that I'm in. I don't want it to be a space that allows fascism or bigotry, and I want it to be radical and include masking requirements, because I want people to come here and not get sick. I want people to be able to live long, healthy lives without developing an autoimmune disease like I have from long COVID. And I really, really hope that people can come check out my art show with some radical queer trans people, some Black, Indigenous, Arab people, Syrian, Lebanese. We are a proud collective called Tribad, TRI.BADE on Instagram. My Instagram is Belly of an Artist, and you can see my art show till July 22nd. We will have a big bash from 5 to 8 p.m. there, and it's at 5859 Southeast 92nd Ave.
Amazing. And we're going to try to squeeze in one more question here, which is our favorite, me and Artie's favorite question, which is, what is a fond memory of queer joy that you have experienced? Aaliyah, do you want to start us off?
Yeah. My mom worked very hard to be with me at every step of my retransition. She was there when I went to the surgery unit. She was there when I started hormones. She was there when I said I didn't feel safe as a transgender person. And she supported me, even though she doesn't understand it personally. It's not her life story. But she made sure that she was going to look out for her kid. And so I am grateful that there are parents everywhere who might not get it, but they are trying their hardest because they love their kid, and not a lot of people have that. And I am so grateful. And anytime I see a parent loving their kid and telling them to keep making art, not shaming them for it, that makes me so proud.
You're listening. You're listening. You're listening. You're listening. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound like a broken record, but you are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon. 90.7 FM. Listen sponsored. Now become a member now. Become a member.